Welcome to ITE 1, Semester 1, Class 2, Module 13. It is Advanced Portable Devices and Laptops. It actually is kind of an advanced chapter, and it's really, really, really interesting because we talk about all sorts of different wireless devices and ways of connecting and sending data, and you're going to find out all you ever wanted to know about Bluetooth, infrared, cellular. Does it? Is it too soft?
Is Grace too soft, guys, or is she right?
She's okay.
Okay.
I think so. And she could always
Wi-Fi.
Get closer to the mic if she wants.
Do you want me to be louder?
Just put the mic a little closer to you.
That any better?
There. That's good.
Okay. And we're going to talk about all the different wireless connections and ways that we do wireless. And then we're going to talk about selecting parts and selecting the right parts and trying not to select the ones that go bang that we buy from eBay. That's going to be about it. And then we're going to talk about labs, if anyone has any questions on labs. And I'll probably be helping a couple people out with a few labs after class. So let's get started. If I can go to the top of my document, which really helps. Okay, as a technician, you are going to be responsible for repairing not only desktops, but laptops. If you didn't already know this, you're in trouble, because we did this in Chapter 6. Was it? Yeah, it was Chapter 6.
And the first thing you really have to know about laptops, before Grace gets onto the actual notes, is that laptops are just like desktops, except they're little, okay? Which means harder to work on. Don't drink 2 glasses of vodka before replacing the hard drive in the laptop. They are
Or if you do, at least YouTube it so we can laugh at you.
Wow.
Yeah, I spilled booze into a laptop. Shockingly, stopped working after that.
Wonder why. Okay.
So I felt really great.
It wasn't somebody else's, hopefully.
No, it was mine, and it was like 4 years old, and I already had a desktop. But yeah, it was just laptop's over with.
God, I don't know that I was committed to that.
An ignominious end to that laptop. Yes.
Oh well. Okay. So, as Kerry said, they're like little desktops. However, there are important differences between the two. To facilitate mobility, laptops and portable devices use wireless technologies more than desktops. Because desktops are stationary, you're more likely to see them hardwired into things. Laptops also use batteries when disconnected from a power source. Don't know how they'd run otherwise, guys.
Actually, to answer that question in all seriousness, the one laptop per child laptop has a dynamo crank handle.
For real? And they can run off
that? Did that actually work well? Because I remember hearing about that, and then it sort of dropped off the news, and I didn't hear anything about it.
You can actually run the laptop off the dynamo, but it does actually have a battery that you can charge. But interestingly enough, one of the biggest advantages to the one laptop per child project laptops was A, they could charge either off solar cells or a dynamo hand crank. And the second thing was that in African homes, unless you've got a fire lit, you don't actually have any light in a lot of the rural villages when the sun goes down. So a lot of people were using the one laptop per child laptops for a lighting source because the screen put out light.
Wow.
So,
like, does anyone... I'm going to, like, look this up because I'm curious how ballsy these laptops were and how much you could actually run these off a dynamo, because that's just really interesting.
You can Linux of some sort, so...
Until Microsoft sort of jumped up and down and went, no, we'll put our operating system on as well, because we couldn't just have them running Linux. Basically, they were a 500 or 600 megahertz processor. They were an ARM-based processor. They weren't an Intel because they're lower. No, actually, it was the AMD Geode 700, now that I think of it. 256 mega RAM and a custom operating system to run on the 6 or 7-inch touchscreen. It also had inbuilt wireless mesh networking, so that if you had a lot of these things in the one area, that would actually network together and you could share data across, say, all of these laptops.
That's cool.
Yeah, that sounds like a really sweet idea.
So they weren't accessible to us. They weren't accessible to us because there wasn't any JAWS and there wasn't any Orca and stuff. But it was actually sort of an embedded application thing, and it had like drawing programs and word processors and stuff on it. But it wasn't your standard commodity laptop that ran your regular.
So it didn't have like a keyboard, right?
Yes, it did. It had a keyboard.
Oh, okay.
Wow, cool. That's absolutely
fun to turn
totally
a crank on a laptop and it would be like one of those emergency radios, and it would go. That'd be so cool.
Well, interestingly enough, as we've been seeing on Twitter, Nokia has released a bicycle-powered phone charger. And, of course, all of the iPhone people are just complaining bitterly because they have more need of the charger and Apple hasn't released one yet. But I'm sure the one that Apple releases will be plastic, square, shiny, with six Apple symbols on it, and won't work unless you're going at 10 kilometers an hour on your bike.
On your iBike.
Get people on tandem bikes, then this charger will work even better.
Anyway, back to the lecture. So laptops usually run off batteries if they are not connected to the wall socket.
Yeah. Docking stations are commonly used to connect laptops to peripheral devices. So it goes to say, without saying, that you will need to know how to configure and provide tech support on these docking stations and many other accessories your clients use with their laptops. Can you think of other accessories you might need to be supporting with laptops?
External keyboards and hard drives and things?
Yeah.
How about external webcams?
I tend to use audio cards.
Okay, an external sound card. Any accessories you use? Yeah, exactly. Anything you use with your laptop?
I'm on there.
Yeah.
Braille displays.
Absolutely. Braille displays.
Yeah, you could.
USB number pads.
Oh, yeah. For us blindies who don't learn the laptop,
actually
good to know.
For sighted people who are doing a lot of accounting work, a number pad is important. And, for example, they want to be holding some papers in one hand and the number pad in the other, so the FNT
totally
method isn't always. Yeah.
Oh, fair enough. All right. Many laptop components are proprietary, whereas your desktop components aren't. You've got desktop components that will fit into a lot of different other desktop components. They're like Legos. They fit together more or less. So if you research it well enough, you're going to probably get a computer when you build it that will all fit together and it'll be all good. Laptops, not so much. You can't just go and buy a new processor easily for a laptop like you can a desktop. You can't just go pick up a new motherboard easily like you can when you're building a desktop.
I highly doubt it, but can laptops actually be built by like people? I know companies.
I think you could.
If you really wanted to, but why would you want to go through that much trouble and just buy?
Yeah, I mean, couldn't you, Gary? Build a laptop?
You can, but generally speaking, the form factors are non-standard. So, for example, the chassis for an Asus EEPC 1000 is HE, is not the same as the chassis for an Asus EEPC 1002. So, it's not really mix and match parts. Whilst a lot of the parts come from some of the companies in China and stuff, it's not really a Lego set. You can replace RAM and hard drives and things. They tend to be consumables, but the actual form factors of the system board and stuff are specific to the laptops.
Right. That's to say, you probably could do. You'd have a really hard time doing it, but you probably could.
Yeah, I was just being goofy with the theoretical.
Oh, yeah. No, theoretically, you probably could do it. I wouldn't try it, though.
No.
So, manufacturers require that you complete specialized certification training, or some of them do, to perform laptop repairs. Servicing laptops can be very challenging because, unlike a desktop, you've got really small spaces to work in. Mastering the skills necessary to work on a laptop is important to your career advancement. Guys, you probably will be doing replacing hard drives and RAM and possibly CD drives, and that's probably going to be it. So, yeah. Wireless devices give people the freedom to work, learn, and play and communicate wherever they want, where there's wireless. Wireless-capable devices do not need to be tied to a physical location to send and receive voice, video, and data communications. Because they are wireless, no cables. As a result, wireless facilities such as internet cafes are open in many countries. McDonald's, free Wi-Fi. But here you only get 500 megs, I think it is. Or 50 megs. 50 megs on free McDonald's internet.
Yeah, that's new.
I didn't know that.
They never used to limit it, but I think people were actually going in and downloading all their Mac updates. And believe me, if you're going from 10.5.1 to 10.5.8...
No, that was 10.5 to 4. The 10.5.7 was like 700 meg at one point.
Okay. You know that college campuses use wireless networks to allow students to sign up for classes, watch lectures, submit assignments in areas where physical connections to the network aren't able to be made. This trend toward wireless communications will continue to grow as more and more people use wireless devices. Yeah, because they will. Because cables...
story here.
Oh, go ahead.
I'll dob him in. Chris Legg's dad was absolutely allergic to wireless, reckoned it was going to cause cancer, the death of 6 million people, goodness knows what else, wouldn't have it in his house. So Chris went and bought a whole stack of Ethernet over power lines, gear, because he wouldn't put wireless in, so he could plug these things into the power points around the house and get connectivity for all the different computers. And funnily enough, as soon as Chris Legg's mother got a netbook, they had to have wireless.
All right. Let's name some types of wireless technologies found on laptops.
Bluetooth.
Yep.
Infrared
is right.
Does anyone still use infrared?
Some of it comes on some laptops. Armando, can you think of any?
Just a regular wireless card.
Absolutely. And the other one that can be in newer laptops now is actual cellular cards. You can actually put a SIM card into some laptops and get 3G wireless coverage. And you've also got satellite. So.
Yeah, my friend Rhonda's laptop had a slot for a SIM card. She wasn't using it, but my friend Josh, who was looking at it, was like, "Oh my god, your laptop has a SIM card." And she said, it has a what? And he explained it to her. She's like, "Oh my god, that's so cool."
Yeah, I want a laptop that does that.
A lot of the newer EEPC netbooks for the 1004, 1005 and higher have the socket. And in fact, the original Acer Aspire 1 actually had the sockets for the SIM card, but they were inactive, which really annoyed all of the people who went and bought one before they did their research.
Hers was a Delvostro, fairly large laptop, I'm surprised it had.
Why wasn't it active?
Because it was in the hardware design, but they hadn't actually put the support in the firmware for it yet.
Okay, most wireless communication systems communicate using radio waves. Some use light. Anyone know which one uses light?
Infrared does.
It does. Wireless cards... if you use the generic Windows client, wireless technologies are less secure than wired technologies. That's not so true, because you can actually put WPA in now and make it secure.
I think I do see their point, though, because I was looking at, on another computer, the Netgear software, and yeah, they've got all the security stuff right there.
Yeah, it hits you in the face.
Yeah, they're a little bit more, it has the box. Is it open or shared or WPA? They make it pretty
obvious.
You
can disable the SSID, or can you, in those utilities?
No, that's for the router, actually, not on your actual computer.
Setup. Yeah, right.
But you can have it tell them that it's a hidden network and that you need to put it in.
Yep.
The only problem with this setup was the Netgear kept popping up a box every time that said, you're connected, and the smart wizard would keep popping up. Stupid.
Yes, I know I'm connected. Thank you.
Dang.
A lot of the times you don't install the smart wizards and stuff if you can get away with it. As previously discussed, you use the Windows Zero Conf tools because the Linksys is even worse. It's got a wizard that pops up that's inaccessible.
I got really lucky with my laptop wireless because it did come up with the wizard, but in the tray icon there was a thing that said switch to Windows Zero Wireless or switch back. Like, there's a little menu option where you can really quickly
switch it.
Either way, this one was really nice.
Actually, the Atheros wireless utilities are excellent and highly accessible, and I would highly recommend them. They've even got a site survey mode that will give you signal strength in percentage or dBm.
Okay, we're going to talk about Bluetooth, which is a wireless technology that enables devices to communicate over short distances. A Bluetooth device can connect up to 7 other Bluetooth devices in your test, in your final, for 11 to 16. To create a personal area network, PAN. This technical specification is described by the Institute of Electrical and Electronics and Engineering, IEEE.
Usually you say IEEE, or you can go make silly noises like Grace.
Basically. It is the 802.15.1 standard, which may also be in your test. 802.15.1. Bluetooth devices are capable of handling voice and data and are ideally suited for connecting the following devices: laptops, printers, cameras, PDAs, cell phones, and hands-free headsets. The distance of a Bluetooth personal area network is limited by the amount of power used by the device in the PAN. Bluetooth devices are broken into 3 classifications. The most common Bluetooth network is Class 2, which has a range of approximately 33 feet or 10 meters. Bluetooth devices operate in the 2.4 to 2.485 gigahertz radio frequency range. That is where many of your older portable phones in the U.S. operate.
And your Wi-Fi networks, the older Wi-Fi networks that use B and G, and the older M ones.
But this is an industrial, scientific, and medical ISM band. This band is often does not require a license if approved equipment is used, and people flog the heck out of it. The Bluetooth standard incorporates adaptive frequency.
What were you talking about? I'm sorry, can you go back to the medical thing? I got interrupted.
Okay, that's okay. The 2.4 gigahertz band that they use is basically an open band for approved devices. So that means that a lot of devices flog the heck out of this band. It can be very cluttered if you have a lot of devices that use the band in your area.
And she was saying that it's called the ISM band, ISM, Industrial Scientific Medical.
Yeah, and if you have a wireless headset, sometimes you can hear that. It'll go, la, 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 and it's like,
oh yeah, it's good.
Things. What? It's fun, yeah.
It is. Okay, so this is interesting and something I didn't know. Bluetooth standard incorporates something called adaptive frequency hopping, AFH. AFH allows signals to hop around using different frequencies within the Bluetooth range, thereby reducing the chance of interference when multiple Bluetooth devices are present. AFH also allows it. Yeah, that's kind of what I thought. It also allows the device to learn frequencies that are already in use and to choose a different subset of frequencies to hop onto.
It all sounds cool. And when Sony Ericsson, funnily enough, did an investigation to find out whether Bluetooth would interfere with Wi-Fi, they claimed that you only lost 10% of your performance. We claim it all goes very slow if you have your Wi-Fi and your Bluetooth active at the same time. So if you are trying to sync stuff up to a phone or whatever via Bluetooth, if you have the option to do this, turn your Wi-Fi off and it will go much faster.
Are you talking about on the same device?
Yes.
Yep.
Okay.
So if you've got an Apple, VoF2 twice quickly and turn off the thing, turn off the AirPort if you're going to do Bluetooth, like extensive Bluetooth. If you're copying like 10, 20, 30 megabytes of data across Bluetooth, really you should probably go and get your cable.
Reader on your phone.
Yes,
well,
yes,
you
yes.
shouldn't do it by Bluetooth, actually.
Yeah, I know, but I actually did that once because the person I was working with had no cable because he never got it with the phone. And it worked. It took ages, but it worked.
Yeah, we actually encourage people, with phones it's not so bad, but we encourage people not to do firmware upgrades via wireless. Yeah. I've seen people do it, and the wireless connection drops out in the middle and breaks their router, and not to do large data transfers by Bluetooth, because you could be copying 100 meg of songs onto your phone, and if you're doing it with Windows Explorer, 93 meg from the end, the Bluetooth connection will die. And this can be very unsatisfying for people.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've got security measures that are included in the Bluetooth standard. Has anyone actually ever paired a Bluetooth device?
Oh,
I'm guessing most of you have.
Yes.
Has anyone not? Okay. So the first time that a Bluetooth device connects, the device is authenticated using a personal identification number. Bluetooth supports 128-bit encryption and PIN authorization. So what is the most commonly used 4-digit PIN for devices? If you get asked for a PIN in Bluetooth and you don't know what it is, what's the first thing you're going to try?
0000.
Absolutely.
The second most common is 1234. It's probably worth mentioning that if you set your PIN to 0000 or 1234 or 1111 or something that is 4 digits long and not particularly complex, then you are at risk of receiving all sorts of nasty Bluetooth viruses. And that's why the manual says you should use a really long PIN, and nobody ever does.
It's funny, when you pair with the Mac, it'll generate like a 5 or 6 digit PIN for you that it wants you to use.
Yeah, Windows does
pair,
that as well. Windows 7 does.
Oh, it does now?
The older Windows will always generate a PIN if you let them, but the fact is that most devices had a hard set PIN and you didn't want it to generate the file, because who wanted to type in 618531422228? It's like, that's too hard. 0000.
Yeah, I can see that. Like, if you're... But some devices, like your earpieces and your Bluetooth display, you can't really... Although, I know the refresher braille, you can't change it, but you should be able to.
No, you can't with the Brailleant either. The other problem, of course, is that you've only got 10 seconds to enter the PIN in once the pairing things... Like, you've only got a limited time to put the PIN in. So the more complex the PIN, the
maybe
less likely you are.
20 seconds, if you're like...
Especially if you're under Windows and you're using the Whitcom Bluetooth stack, by the time your jaw's cursoring around to mouse and click on the balloon that's popped up to say that there's a pairing request, you may or may not get the PIN in time.
And some devices are quite cranky if you have to do it a second time.
I still cannot get my Windows mobile phone to see my Mac to actually like each other, which shouldn't be surprising, but oof.
Sucks. Okay. Infrared. Does anyone have any questions on Bluetooth or how to do anything with Bluetooth or any of that?
You said that IEEE was 802.15.1. Is that right?
Yeah.
I know that's going to come
right.
back and haunt me at some point on the test or somewhere. Because they seem to really push these.
Little standards, yeah. Anyone else, any questions on Bluetooth? Okay.
If you want battery power to be conserved, get rid of it if you don't need it, because it will go
this is true. And Wi-Fi.
Battery power right.
Also,
yeah,
if you actually stop your Bluetooth devices from being discoverable, that will save a lot of battery power. And in fact, most of the people that complain about their batteries on their phones being low or running out quickly have Bluetooth turned on, have their devices discoverable, and the really clever ones have their Wi-Fi turned on as well. So if you're, say for example, running a Nokia phone, turn off Bluetooth, turn off Wi-Fi if you're not using them. If you can't turn off Bluetooth, do your discovering of your devices and your cars and all that sort of thing so that you can do the Bluetooth switch out to the, you know, speakers and stuff, and then make the devices undiscoverable.
Yeah, my mom was so amazed when I told her to just turn it off while she's not with the using the headset. She's like, oh my God, that helped so much.
Oh, yeah.
But if you don't want to remember to turn it on, you can just set it to turn discovery off. My device is visible in searches, and that will also save you probably 70% of the power that you'd save by...
Yeah, you know. I can see that, totally.
Okay, we've got infrared. And I seriously have not used infrared on a computing device probably since about 10th grade when I had a Braille note. No, it was like 10th, 11th grade when I had a Braille note with an infrared Braille infrared dongle.
I was just going to mention the first time I'd ever heard about infrared ports was when I heard about and then got a Braille note. I wonder if they still have...
No. Do you remember having to line them up with the little thing on the printer? And half the time it would work, and half the time it wouldn't.
My laptop is so old that it still has one on the front, and I actually did get them to see each other for ActiveSync one. Just for that.
That's so funny.
I think the other thing is, with Bluetooth, the first time I heard about Bluetooth was when we got a video recorder in 1982, and it had an infrared remote control. And yes, the remote control signals for infrared are compatible between computers and mobile phones and infrared controls. And if you get a thing called SILOC, Total IR, you can actually send remote control codes from your phone to your air conditioner, video recorder, television, DVD player, etc. And of course, in pure Linux style, there is a utility called LIRC, the Linux Infrared Controller. And it has about devices for about 10 or 20,000 different things. So you just load the codes in, and if your transmitter has got enough bandwidth to transmit them, it will transmit as many of those different pulses as it can. The other useful device that you can get is a thing called a TV Begone, which has got nothing to do with laptops. And you hold the button down, and it sends about 3,000 different off signals, and once your television responds to the off signal, it will shut down. This is quite fun to do in a department store with about 20 televisions.
I'm going to go here, and if anybody remembers the Furby, they actually had an infrared sensor that was like the light sensor. So when the two Furbies actually got close to each other and they would interact with each other, that's what they used. Was these light sensors that people were trying to like hack the Furby, and I think they actually did.
I read some reviews, and it said that the Furby had an 8-bit processor. It didn't have much RAM, and hacking it was a complete waste of time. Apart from making it go, oh no, light, about 6 times.
Yeah.
There really wasn't much you could do. In fact, the Microsoft Smart Toys were more hackable than the Furby.
But people still tried to do it anyway. And that's the cool part.
People will hack anything.
Is the people
that's actually the one thing I really liked about the Pac-Mate was that you could use the infrared port on it to program and use it as a remote for your appliances.
I wanted
you had to
try
have the
that.
Remote,
I thought that'd be
though,
so
for the
cool.
Thing, right?
It was a free app.
Well, the other thing was,
but you had to teach it. Like, if you had the, you had to have like the VCR remote, and then it had to learn what the power code was and what the play. So it's not quite as cool as what Carrie was just talking about. You had to actually teach it.
But afterwards,
and this is another thing that a lot of people don't realize, and this is not relevant to laptops as such, but learnable remotes, you do have to teach them. So if it says 57 in one learnable remote for $20, you're either going to have to put in an incomprehensible button sequence to teach it, or you are actually going to have to train it what the codes for whatever it is that it's actually going to control.
Oh, another fun fact, Carrie actually bought a Furby.
Yeah, I kind of want another one.
Creep me out.
I kind of want another one. I had one of the original ones.
I think the funniest thing about me buying a Furby, and well, we will get back to Lecture in a second, was I actually came across these kids that had a Furby, and the first thing the kids showed me was how to freak it out. They're like, stick your finger in its mouth and keep your finger in its mouth. Now turn it upside down. Now shake it. Now if you belt it on this bit, I'm just like, guys, you guys have got far too much free time.
Oh, they didn't like being upside down, that's for sure.
Well, the funny thing was, and I'm just like, this is your Furby? And I'm like, that's okay. We've already done all this stuff. It's kind of cool.
Poor electronic device.
They have feelings too, supposedly.
That's okay. The sad thing was, I sort of looked at these kids and went, yeah, you guys are related to me, aren't you?
Okay. Infrared wireless technology is a low-power, short-range, short-range wireless technology which uses light waves as a data transmission medium. IR operates at a low power in a short range of 1 meter, that's 3 feet, and with low throughput. IR cannot penetrate any object that blocks the light signal. IR is susceptible to interference and delusion. Scatter IR can connect without line of scatter IR can connect without line of sight, but data transfer rates are lower and distances are shorter.
Has anybody ever noticed that dogs have a habit of lying in front of infrared sensors? You usually can't change the channel because the dog is in the way.
Or people.
Or I know the people blind who person, can
you're
block
waving
out.
The remote, you're waving the remote around wildly trying to figure out where exactly to point this stupid thing.
Yeah, where's the line of sight? Oh, I'm very.
Actually, that's an interesting point because I remember I went over to a blind person's place, and they had a stereo system with a remote control, and they were complaining that the remote control wasn't working, and I actually found that they were actually pointing the LED at their stomach. And once I actually faced them towards the stereo system and pointed it at the stereo, it actually worked really, really well. And they're like, oh, okay. We actually have a friend who can block out Wi-Fi. If she stands between your laptop and the access point, it's all over.
Is that the one who fell down?
And she's proud of this. Yes. Yeah. Okay, so with infrared devices, you can feel the LED on an infrared device. It's a little bulb-type thing on the end. So you're going to feel for that little bulb, and you're going to point it at the device you want to control, if it's a remote control.
Just be aware, some LEDs, some infrared devices do have a flat glass across the front of it, and you won't be able to feel the bulb in that case. You have to feel for the flat, smooth plastic/glass covering.
Security concerns are not applicable to IR because, seriously, you can't do anything with it from anywhere farther than about arm's length. Do very well with a computer.
We actually found that you could, and in fact there were printers that have a 10 meter range, and one of my friends who had the printer in line of sight with him in the classroom, and the infrared was still turned on and it kept going and popping up the infrared connect dialogue on his laptop, so he sent a sheet of paper to the printer that said, help, I'm trapped inside this printer, please turn my infrared off, and they finally did.
Okay, well, I've never had much luck with any farther than arm's length myself, but there are four types of infrared networks. We've got your standard line of sight signal is transmitted only if there is a clear, unobstructed view between devices. Scatter signal is bounced off the ceiling and walls. We've got reflective. A signal is sent to an optical transceiver and is reflected to the receiving device. I've never seen anything that does this, I don't think. In the last one, we were talking about broadband optical telepoint. Transmission can handle high-quality multimedia requirements. This is usually between your computer and your projector. Infrared networks are ideal for connecting laptops to devices in close proximity, such as multimedia projectors, PDAs, printers, remote controls, wireless mice, and wireless keyboards. The setup configuration IR devices is quite simple. Many IR devices connect to the USB port on a laptop or desktop computer. It can be a dongle. Once the computer detects the new device, Windows XP installs the appropriate drivers. The installation is similar to setting up a local area network connection. IR is a practical short-range connection solution, but it has some limitations, which we talked about. It is very, very short range. It can have a lot of interference, and if it's not line of sight and it's not scatter, it's not going to happen. Any questions on infrared? Cool. We'll go on to the really exciting one, cellular technologies. These only originally transmitted voice, but now are capable of transmitting voice, video, and data simultaneously. Laptops, cell phones, PDAs, and smartphones can connect to a cellular WAN as long as the cellular tower is not more than several miles away and as long as they are equipped to do so. As in the case of laptops and PDAs, you need to have a SIM card in, or on some networks it is just built in. Do they still have, does Verizon use SIM cards yet, or are they still not using SIM cards?
No, but you get the USB dongle or the PCI, or the, you know, the Express card thing, but no, they're not using SIM cards, and probably won't be.
Because I didn't think CDMA used SIMs either.
No, they don't. Doesn't.
That's CDMA.
No, it doesn't.
We have lots of CDMA over here with the Telstra networks because of the distances. You can't stick a mobile signal on a kangaroo.
Yeah, you wouldn't want to. Anyway. But yeah, they have a USB. They call it an air card, which I hate that name for it, but that does help distinguish.
Yeah, it's a bad name.
Well, it was because of airtime, you know. You get 30 minutes of airtime back in the 1990s.
I remember when Verizon was AirTouch Cellular here.
Okay, although slower than DSL and cable connections, cellular WANs are still fast enough to be classified as high-speed connections. They're faster than dial-up most of the time. To connect a laptop to the cellular WAN, you should install an adapter that is designed to work with cellular networks. A cellular adapter needs to support some or all of the following. We've got Global System for Mobile Communication, GSM. This is a worldwide cellular network. We've got General Packet Radio Service, GPRS. This is a data service for users of GSM. Quad band allows a cellular phone to operate on all four GSM frequencies. These are 850, 900, 1800, and 1900 megahertz. So we'll go over some terms here. We've got short messaging service, SMS. These are text messages. Multimedia service, MMS. These are multimedia messages, including pictures and sound. Enhanced data rate for GSM Evolution, Edge, provides increased data rates and improved data reliability. And Evolution Data Optimized, EVD, faster download rates. I've never heard of that last one.
GSM. Yeah, I think it is. I was just going to say, everybody's also aware that on the Nokia phones, for example, the three dots, the two dashes, and the three dots actually spells out SMS in Morse code. I'm sure we all knew that.
Yeah.
And the big long one that goes da 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 da, etc. 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 is connecting people in Morse code. If you've got that one turned on.
Oh, okay.
You can make Nokia actually do the beeps for those.
That is sorry. Yeah.
You can make the phones do. Oh wow.
No. They just have those as tones that you can choose.
Oh, I'll have to play around with another Nokia phone then.
Yeah. Cellular WAN cards are plug and play. Maybe these cards plug into the PC card slot or are built into the laptop. Or you can get the USB dongles. Those are good too. Any questions on that? We good? We awake?
Yeah, I think
so. Okay. Wi-Fi. Wi-Fi is a wireless technology that provides a simple connection to a WAN from anywhere within range of a base station. To connect to Wi-Fi, or WLAN networks must be in range of the wireless access point. Yeah. The wireless technology Wi-Fi is based on IEEE 802.11 working standards and specifications. The number 802.11 denotes a set of standards that are specified in the IEEE 802.11 documentation. The terms 802.11 and Wi-Fi are interchangeable. The 802.11G standard was released in 2003 and is currently the most common Wi-Fi standard. I think it still actually is. The 802.11 standard was released in draft form in 2006 and now actually has been modified and is now actually an IEEE standard. There are currently four major Wi-Fi 802.11 standards.
Bang!
Yeah.
B-A-N-G.
Wow, I still never thought of that.
Yeah, but do you remember that A came before B?
Yeah, that's fine. ABGN is the order that they were actually released, but if you want to remember them all, bang is the word you need to remember.
Yep.
We all know that A runs at 5.8 gigahertz, B and G run at 2.4 gigahertz. The difference between B and G is the type of multiplexing that is used on the carrier wave, and N runs on either 2.4 or 5 gigahertz, and the MIMO, multiple in, multiple out technologies, can provide a theoretical maximum transfer rate of 300 megabits per second if you are sitting on top of the access point.
The other thing you got to be careful is if you have B and G devices on the same link, the G devices will slow down to match the B devices, so you be careful. And I was surprised that the wireless chapter in the networking in the earlier part of the course never actually mentioned that.
No, it doesn't.
Only on some routers.
No, it's only if your router sucks. The G devices don't always slow down to B. That was actually a misnomer. If you are talking from a B device to a G device, they'll slow down. But if you think about it, if the traffic is going, say, for example, from your laptop to the access point and then out to the internet and you've got a G laptop, the only time it slows down to B is if it's actually going out to a B device.
Does tomato fix that?
Does tomato what?
Fix that so that it doesn't slow
down. Most routers don't slow down anymore. It's just that people expected to get G speeds from their G laptop to their B laptop, and that didn't happen. I think it was just people doing bad benchmarks and other people forgetting that wireless really was half duplex and not factoring that in.
Okay. Security is a major concern for wireless networks. Anyone within coverage area of a wireless router can potentially gain access to the network. The security features of Wi-Fi include VPNs, WPA encryption, and authentication, and other security settings. Specific there, guys.
MAC address filtering, etc.
Yeah. Wi-Fi protected access standards, WPA, WPA2, are used to secure Wi-Fi networks. WPA uses a sophisticated encryption authentication technology to protect data flow between Wi-Fi devices. WPA uses, and this is in your final somewhere, 128-bit encryption keys and should be enabled on all wireless devices if they support it. WPA was introduced to replace wireless equivalent privacy, or wired equivalent privacy, WEP, which had known security issues. All right, finally, satellite. This provides two-way upload and download internet access in rural areas where cable and DSL may not be able to reach. You need to have a satellite dish installed. That means you need specialized equipment, such as a satellite dish. It is not as fast as DSL, but It is considered high speed. You can usually get up to 500 kbps download, and your upload may be handled by a phone line, whereas where you'll only get 50 kbps up. So it is very asynchronous. Any questions on that?
Those speeds are much higher, and we do have bi-directional satellite communication now, but it wasn't really popular. Yeah, we didn't used to. I remember you used to be able to get, like, iHug, which was one of our internet service providers that would give you satellite access for $30 a month once you paid for the dish and the equipment, and you would get 400 kilobits per second down, which was fast for 2000, and 30 kilobytes, 30, sorry, three or four kilobytes per second up.
Yeah, Hughes Direct was one of the first ones here, and I think they were... By the way, I want to go back to Wi-Fi security for just a minute.
Okay.
Isn't one of the WPA things called WPA PSK with a passkey? How does that work?
Okay, you've got two types of WPA authentication. You've got WPA PSK, which stands for pre-shared key. That just means you put the same password. If the password on the access point is Snooky Bobbles, you put Snooky Bobbles into the laptop. Then you have got WPA Enterprise, which uses RADIUS, Remote Authentication Dial-In User Service, which actually uses public certificates and passwords and a RADIUS server. There is also a protocol in there called TKIP, which stands for Temporal Key Integrity Protocol, which is the protocol that is responsible for changing the encryption keys between the stations and the access point at a predetermined interval.
I guess I should try and figure out this then, because right now we have a fairly low security web key that I have managed to memorize, but I really want something more secure and something that the people who do need to remember it around here can remember, so I might actually look at... I'm just hoping everything that we have...
You can put anything in for it. You can put... Yeah. You can put anything in as a WPA.
No, with WEP... To maintain compatibility across all devices, you have to do it in hex, because not all devices encrypt the password for WEP in the same way. There are actually about three or five different hashing algorithms. For WPA and WPA 2,
I want to get something...
With WPA and WPA 2, the password gross actually has to be at least 8 characters long.
Yeah, I think it's 7. But you could put... You don't have to be hex.
No, you don't have to be hex. But if you put in a weak password, then somebody's going to eat it with a dictionary attack anyway.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, yeah. But you can put... It's not a hex thing, that's what I meant, but you can put anything you want in there.
That's why
And in fact, if Grace is typing in and it's got this horrible mix of, like, phone stuff and braille and capital and lowercase letters, so you just go and shoot yourself and change it to Love, Sex, Secret.
It's awesome.
Braille is a great thing to use in password.
Oh, yeah, I know. I've got some Braille. I have this password that is like Braille.
Do you use like the
dot configurations and hex all sorts of weird stuff?
I think the thing that annoyed me is she set up an ad hoc network with one of these evil passwords, and I'm just like, why couldn't you just put testing in or something? This is an ad hoc network that we're using for 20 minutes, and you have to put in a password like that.
I used to use, like, actual, like, but for B and can for C. I used to actually spell things out, but do it that way.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah, that's
can
a good
be fun.
Idea.
That can be fun, too, and it's kind of easy to remember for you, but then if you've got somebody who doesn't know Braille,
for no one
like,
else,
what?
Yeah. Absolutely, it's awesome.
It's funny to try and tell a sighted person those sorts of passwords, though, because they don't know what all the letters are, and then they just end up writing it on a piece of paper, and yeah.
Poor them.
Yeah. Well, why? I mean, most of mine is a pretty easy Braille. It was just numbers for letters that represented to Braille dots, and nothing really interesting. Anyway, we're going to talk about laptops and repairing them now, and laptops going bang, and it'll be fun. All right. We've got two types of replaceable unit, CRUs, customer replaceable units. They can be replaced by the customer, hopefully, if the customer's smart enough. These are things such as batteries, RAM, I don't know.
Oh, the way you said that was so wrong. I know what you
what
meant.
Do you mean?
But, oh, if the customer's smart enough. That sounded kind of mean.
Well, look.
I know what you
you'll
mean.
You'll get calls about doing these kind of things, guys. They're saying a reasonably intelligent person should be able to replace these. But you'll get calls on these, and you've got to be patient with people and help them out.
The other thing is you have to make
an... My manual says a reasonably intelligent person can do this. What's your problem? And then hang up.
We don't say that. I'm just telling you guys.
The other thing is you have to make an assertion as to whether, if you're working at a company that's, say, selling out spare parts or whatever, you sometimes have to make an assertion based on warranty claims and stuff as to whether you believe that the person that you're potentially going to send these parts to is going to be able to install them or whether they perhaps should take it into a repair center.
The things that your customers should be able to install on their own are batteries, RAM, depending on the laptop. RAM is a sticky one, and I'd really call that an FRU that needs to be worked on by an experienced technician, but that's just me. If the test asks you, RAM is a customer replaceable unit. PC cards, adapters for the PC cards, and battery chargers. That should all be able to be done by the customer. Field replaceable units.
What about the pull-out optical drives?
Depends on the computer.
Couldn't the customer do that too? Like mine, you pull a little thing towards the back of the computer, and you go whoop, and the optical drive just slides out. I think a battery is also supposed to, or potentially able to go in there, so it's really easy to pull.
I guess that could be too, but I wonder how common that actually is. Probably not anymore.
Some computers do that. It really depends on the computer. What is a CRU versus an FRU, and you need to make that assumption based on the person you're talking to and the laptop and all of that. So your FRU should only be replaced by a qualified field technician. That's us. Some examples of FRUs are RAM on a motherboard, internal hard drive, LCD displays, and keyboards. There are fewer CRUs and FRUs with laptops than with desktops. There are more repair centers and manufacturer repairs with laptops than with desktops. The experience of the customer determines whether the repair will be done by the customer or the field tech. Some repair centers are capable of doing more specialized repairs than others. If a local repair center cannot repair the laptop, it is returned to the manufacturer for the repair, and you wait and you cry because you're not getting that back for a while. It is important to understand when each of these repairs should be utilized. A technician at a repair center can provide standard service on laptops made by different manufacturers, or a repair center may specialize in a specific brand and be considered an authorized dealer for warranty work and repairs. A lot of Mac places do this. They're just Macs. Repair centers can perform more extensive diagnostics and intricate repairs. If no local services are available, the laptop may need to be sent to a regional repair center or to the manufacturer. If laptop damage is severe or requires specialized software and tools, the manufacturer can decide to replace the laptop instead of attempting a repair. Or they might just send it back to you and say, tough.
Ah, does anybody remember when Apple was doing that with iPods and you'd spend all this money to send the iPod in and then they would just go, not repairable, buy another one. And they weren't actually sending you a new one back. They were saying, not repairable, buy another one.
I don't remember that.
Laptops and devices with...
But there are third-party iPod repair places if you really... if it's really, you know, especially if it's really old... There are places.
Well, sometimes if you actually had a system board failure, an actual system board failure, not a dead hard disk or a broken screen or whatever, if you actually sent them into Apple, they wouldn't even bother sending it back to you. They'd just go, nah, consumable, not replaceable, not interested. And that upset a lot of users.
Oh, yeah. Okay, things like netbooks with smaller form factors may You may have more expensive repairs and replacements because they are smaller. Before attempting a laptop repair yourself, check the warranty to see if the repair will void the warranty. And if it will, it must be done at an authorized repair center so you don't invalidate the warranty. If you repair a laptop yourself, and even if you're going to send it in, guys, you should always back up the data and disconnect the device from the power source. Well, yeah, back up the data.
Everybody's heard that recording I was passing around? The help desk one where Stephen Thrasher lost all of the information on his Canon laptop? Well, what you can do, though, is if say, for example, the laptop won't boot, you can actually remove the hard drive and put it onto a USB to hard disk adapter or in one of the little docking stations if it's a SATA. And many a time have I copied data off a laptop hard drive that has been pulled out of an unwell laptop.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
There may be warranty distance limitations for free repairs. So if you're out of the country, they might not cover you at all. You might have to actually drive your computer into a center, or you might actually have to send it in and pay shipping. So there may be costs with warranties. You guys get to do the activity researching a computer repair center, and you get to answer questions about the results of your research. So can anyone think of a computer repair center that people might want to call?
I know there's the place here, Micro Center, that I bought my Mac from that's an Apple authorized, that it might be fun to talk to them again.
Absolutely.
And they put more RAM in for me and stuff.
You can always ask the manufacturer of your laptop usually has service centers in your area.
Yeah, another really good one if you guys don't have a Micro... Yeah, if you guys don't have any Micro Centers or anything, Best Buy's Geek Squad, a really good repair. Well, I don't know how good, but it's a repair center, you can call them.
Some people have had really good experience with them, and some people have not.
I think that goes for any repair center, and it really depends on the technicians that are working there.
If you don't buy it from Best Buy, they're really not going to be likely to help you. I mean, they're very picky about whether you bought it from them. If you bought it from them, then, oh yeah, you get better, you get high priority. But if you didn't, then they may not even do it.
I haven't found that, because Geek Squad is not quite affiliated with Best Buy, and they are there to help to repair any device and take your money for it. It costs a lot.
Yeah, they used to be pretty tight. They must not be anymore.
If it's actually just like free warranty support, yeah, they are. But they'll take your money for just about any computer problem.
I remember we had an instance a few years back, actually, and I won't say who it was because it's somebody we know. I was charging $20 an hour for my computer repair service, and they sort of had a squawk. They're like, oh, well, that cost me $80, and that cost me $30, and that cost me $40. I said, fine, take it somewhere else, and... Because I was charging $20 to look at it. I'm like, look, $20 for me to even look at it because I've got to come out and all this sort of stuff. And they went and rang up one of the places, which was PC Doctor, and it was going to be $100 an hour if you bought it to them, or $120 an hour if they came out to your house to fix it. Funnily enough, the $20 for me to look at it was very forthcoming once they'd done a few call arounds and quotes.
Yeah, I can see.
And then I used to go and spend my money at Hungry Jack's. Anyway, I don't want to talk about that anymore because it's making me hungry. I could really go a whopper.
Hungry Jack's. Someone bring us. Oh, that'd be good.
You know what, though?
Yeah,
The other thing to think about, and the only reason I did this is because I just did it for my non-laptop, but still very small and possible droppable computer, and that is extended warranties on laptops. If you can afford it, definitely do it.
Yeah.
Although careful about the extended warranty coverage rules. A lot of them in Australia and stuff, and a lot of them wherever they can get away with it, do not cover user-inflicted damage. And if they can prove you dropped it, they won't cover it.
It's still better. I think it's still probably better to have it, though.
I agree.
Than not have.
Absolutely. Extended warranty is always a good thing to have, but it's like your insurance policy. Please consider the product disclosure statement when deciding this insurance is right for you. If you're going to insure something or you're going to get a warranty, which is basically a form of insurance, you better make sure that you're actually insuring it for the things that you think you are, so that the sharks aren't just going to take your money.
Fair enough. And if you want to insure something and you want a really good deal, and they do, I do have one of my phones insured by them, Square Trade will give you a very good deal on some accident insurance. If you lose it, though, you're out of luck, if you lose the product. But if it gets broken, smashed into little bits, if you still got the pieces, they will give you...
Some of your money back was the end of that sentence.
Up to $400 worth, I think, for phones.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
It's good. Okay, you might want to replace parts if the original parts are damaged or if additional functionality is needed to increase performance. You can upgrade a laptop by either adding additional components or replacing the original ones. If you replace components, the new components must fit both physically and electronically. If you add components, you must make sure they are compatible and do not exceed the wattage of the power supply. Adding and replacing components is a good way to make things go bang if you don't do this. Components generally fall into two categories. We've got retail packaging and original equipment manufacturer, OEM. The retail packaging usually comes with the components, the documentation, a full warranty, cables, mounting hardware, drivers, and software in a really pretty box. OEM components are usually sold without packaging. OEM components require the user to locate documentation, software drivers, and any additional hardware that may be needed. OEM components are usually much less expensive and offer a shorter warranty period than the original retail packaged components.
Also, sometimes there are purchasing restrictions on OEM components. In fact, we were talking about this the other day. If you buy an OEM copy of Windows, which a lot of people do, it's actually locked to the specific machine that you buy it for. Like, once you install it on a machine and you activate it, it actually is fingerprinted to that machine. And whilst you can sometimes call up Microsoft and convince them to reactivate it for you, it really does become a pain. If you actually buy the retail edition of Windows, it isn't locked to a specific machine. You just run it on one at a time, which is an interesting point to be aware of. So it's often worth paying more for the retail so that you're not locked into a specific machine, because as far as Microsoft is concerned, once that equipment dies, that license of Windows is now invalid, and things like changing your hard drives and stuff can skew your activation key.
The key stickers are actually different colors too on some machines. If the machine came with I think the retail is like silver and the OEM is black, or maybe it's the other way around, but I think sometimes the color of the label that the key is written on is supposed to be able to tell you whether it was an OEM license of Windows or if a retail license of Windows is there.
There are also other ways of telling. There's actually an INI file that you can look in. I'd have to actually Google up the article, but you can actually post-mortem a hard drive and find out which version of Windows was on it in case you have to reinstall the OEM copy or the retail copy. Whilst we certainly do not condone this behaviour, there are also methods of turning retail copies into OEM copies and vice versa, and we will not talk about any more about that on this lecture, just to say that it can be done. There's also a nifty trick that if you delete a file off the Windows 7 CD, the actual INI that tells it what it is, it will actually pop you up a menu and ask you which version you'd like to install, all the way from Home Starter all the way up to Ultimate. However, note that you will need the correct key. Now, one of the other things I'd warn people as well, and this goes for laptops especially, so it is kind of relevant to this lecture, is when you actually get a laptop, either use Magical Jelly Bean Key Finder, which is often reported as a Trojan by a lot of virus utilities, or get somebody to read you the keys off the stickers, because they do rub off, and if ever you need to reload stuff onto the laptop, it can be very difficult to get your hands on the keys if it's rubbed off the stickers and the hard drive has been deleted or whatever.
Looks like Bellark might give you the key, sort of.
Oh, actually it does, too.
Yeah,
the new one.
Yeah, but Magical Jelly Bean lets you change it, which Bellark certainly doesn't.
That was not true.
The Windows 7 one actually has limitations on how you can and can't change it. It is, you can change it more than you used to be able to, but they do lock certain things out with Jelly Bean. You can set it to whatever you like. Whether it'll work or not is another thing altogether.
Fair enough.
I always think of Magical Jelly Bean Dictionary, because there's that too. And I'm always like, which Magical Jelly Bean are we talking about?
Key Finder.
Yeah, I know. Just
saying. Is it by the same guy?
Don't know. It's actually cool, though. It connects to a dictionary server, and you can get the full dictionary of online computing, and you can use all... I mean, there's
Sweet.
Tons of dictionaries you can tell this thing to...
Oh, that's some Foldoc, or whatever it's called. I remember that.
Yeah, Foldoc. Yeah.
Okay. The OEMs can give you substantial savings when you're doing bulk upgrades of laptops and when additional support is not needed. Pricewatch.com does tons of OEM stuff. Laptop battery may need to be replaced if the laptop shuts off immediately when AC power is removed. That's a really good sign, guys. The battery is leaking. Don't use the battery if it's leaking. The battery is overheating. Especially don't use it then, because you can burn down things. The battery will not hold a charge. If you experience problems that you suspect are battery-related, exchange the battery with a known good battery that is compatible with the laptop. Replacement battery cannot be located. Take the battery to an authorized repair center for testing. Always follow the instructions provided by the manufacturer when charging a new battery. The laptop can be used during an initial charge, but do not unplug the AC adapter. Batteries have memories. NiCad and NiMH rechargeable batteries should occasionally be discharged completely to remove the charge memory. When the battery is completely discharged, it should then be charged to maximum capacity, just like you did your first charge.
And this is a good point. One of the things that a lot of people do is they get their shiny new laptop, netbook, whatever thing, and the manual says in big letters on the front of the thing, please charge this before you use it. No, they don't do that. They just plug it in for 15 minutes, muck around with it, and then take it out in front of the TV, and then wonder why it goes flat, and then why they don't have any battery life and stuff. And in fact, I remember when Gemma's brand new Tekra laptop turned up, and she was at university, and I rang her up and said, oh, your laptop is here and it's in a box. Would you like to come home and unpack it and stuff? She's like, no, get it out of its box and charge it. So I actually unpacked it all out of the box and put it on the charge so that when she came home, it was all full of juice and ready to use.
I actually had a situation where I didn't realize that my dad took the battery off the laptop and said, uh-oh, part of this looks like it's sort of melting and caving in, so don't use this anymore. And I'm like, oh, I didn't know that. Like, part of the battery that faces in towards the laptop was sort of deformed or something. And I'm like, okay, I didn't know that. I won't use it anymore. If I'd have known that, I would have stopped using it.
So that's why we take our batteries off every month or two, and you give it a good feel when you take it off and check for abnormalities. You do. You want to take your battery off every month or two and feel it and make sure there's no bulging and make sure there's no melted bits and make sure it still feels okay. Make sure that it's not leaking somewhere. It's very important to do that.
Yeah, it's a good idea.
Quite honestly. Anyway, the other thing you need to know about batteries is that you need to take care when handling them. Batteries can explode if improperly charged, shorted, or mishandled. Be sure that the battery charger is designed for the chemistry size and voltage of your battery. Otherwise, it won't charge, or worse, it will have problems with your battery, burn out the battery, burn out some of the circuitry in your laptop, which is very hard to replace if at all replaceable, and you'll be very sad.
One of the other problems we had a few years ago, which is why people have really started pushing this very hard, is that often people would carry a couple of spare mobile phone batteries around with them, because in case their battery went flat, they'd charge up a couple of batteries in a desk charger and drop them in the bag with their car keys. Hello.
Yep, bad idea.
Also, remember that batteries are considered toxic waste, and you need to dispose of them accordingly. Check your local laws. Guidelines for emplacing a battery include that the battery matches the model of the laptop, it fits the laptop, battery connections are compatible, and has the correct voltage, or else you're going to fry your laptop, or it won't work. Okay, so you guys get to research batteries. You get to research a manufacturer's battery, and you can either do this on your laptop, or you can research a battery, RAM, and whatever else for an EEEPC-1000HE. Your choice.
That's a triple A PC if you didn't want to count her EEEs.
You want to research a generic battery, which means it's not branded by the manufacturer, and you want to research a manufacturer battery. And you get to make a choice as to which battery you are going to buy. Any questions on that?
That could be fun if the laptop's really old.
Yeah. Well, that's why I gave you another one that you can do, because I know that the batteries for that are out there. Okay. Docking stations and port replicators may contain SCSI ports, a networking port, PS2 ports, USB ports, and a game port. A port replicator has the same things, except it can also have additional hard drive bays, PCI card slots, optical drives, and floppy drives.
Well, hang on, I think you've got that backwards.
Docking station?
The docking stations can have those. Replicator. The port replicators can have them.
Yeah, okay, I said that wrong.
So the docking station's got all the extra bits.
Yeah, the port replicators only replicate ports.
Sometimes the docking stations supposedly have speakers, too.
Yeah,
some do.
I had one that had speakers, it had two PCI slots, it had really good speakers too, and it had a SCSI port, and it had a slide-in thing for like a CD-ROM and stuff. It was wild.
Did they ever make docking stations with eSATA ports?
Yeah, they're actually port replicators with eSATA ports, yes. Although keep in mind that usually if they've got eSATA ports, you've got to have a laptop that actually supports the pass-through of the eSATA. Generally speaking, if your laptop doesn't have that sort of capability, you end up with USB to eSATA bridges, which are a pain.
On that note, you want to make sure that the docking station that you buy is compatible with your laptop. The best way I've found is that most websites, when you are going to buy your docking station, have a compatibility list of computers. If your computer isn't on that list, don't buy the docking station. You can add separate hardware profiles for docked and undocked states. Many of these proprietary and only support certain models, like an Apple docking station can only do Mac. The guidelines for selecting a docking station or port replicator, of course, match the laptop. It fits the laptop and is compatible with the docking connection. And you guys get to research a docking station. Storage devices, they say, are CRUs unless a warranty requires the technical assistance, or if you've got to take the entire back off the computer and go through 20 million different screws and latches to get them out. There are several options for adding or replacing or upgrading storage devices for a laptop. External USB hard drives, FireWire hard drives, or DVD and CD burners. Before purchasing a new internal or external hard drive, check the laptop documentation or the website of the manufacturer for compatibility requirements. Documentation often contains frequently asked questions that may be helpful. It is also important to research known laptop component issues on the internet. Sean did some work on a problem with a laptop and inadvertently found some compatibility component issues with a laptop of his.
Yeah, I found something that fixed something my dad was having, and like it said, this particular type of hard drive is really noisy, and I had noticed that. Well, they ended up having a firmware update for that hard drive. It didn't work for mine,
but it worked for his, so.
You want to make sure that the external or internal drives are compatible and will actually work with your computers? If you are going to stick something into a drive bay, you want to make sure it actually fits that drive bay. And you guys get to research DVD-ROM drives for laptops. Selecting additional RAM. Additional RAM speeds up the process by decreasing the number of times the operating system reads and writes data to the hard drive swap files. Reading and writing data directly from RAM is faster than using swap files. See Chapter 12. Also, RAM helps the operating system run multiple applications more effectively. Most laptops use a small profile memory chip that is called Small Outline DIMM. SODIMM. When replacing or adding memory, determine if the laptop has available slots to add memory, and that the laptop supports the quantity and type of memory to be added. Little tip, notebooks and netbooks both use SODIMM memory, unless otherwise stated. You want to take a look at the specifications for your netbook or laptop just to double check what form factor your memory will be in. Before purchasing installing RAM, consult the manufacturer's website for specifications and known compatibility problems. Use the documentation to find where to install RAM on the laptop, because it's different for every laptop. It's not like a desktop. It's all proprietary, and each laptop is different. On most laptops, RAM is inserted into a slot behind a cover on the underside of the case, but then again, some laptops don't have RAM doors, and you've got to take them apart.
Some of them put it, like mine, under the wrist rest, like right behind, right in front of the keyboard in there somewhere on the left-hand side.
You all know how to confirm the currently installed amount of RAM by pressing Alt-Enter on my computer and looking at your system properties.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay, and you guys have an activity doing laptop RAM. All right, preventative maintenance. Of course, preventative maintenance should be scheduled at regular intervals to keep laptops running properly. Because laptops are portable, they are more likely to be exposed to harmful materials and situations than desktops that sit in the same place. Properly managing data files and folders can ensure data integrity when data is transferred between laptops and desktops. So keep organized, guys, and you won't lose your stuff. You definitely want to clean out the grills on your laptops. For us blind people, this means cleaning the screen. Make sure to wipe your screen down with a soft cloth, if you can, every couple weeks, because they get dirty and you won't
notice. And they've got LCD wipes, too. And those are actually really cool.
They do.
I bought some for my iPod, and they're neat.
We talk a little bit about disk cleanup and disk defragmentation, which we've talked about before. So if you need help on that, you can ask questions now or refer to your notes. Any questions on either of those?
It wouldn't be too different for laptops and versus
desktops. No, it's the same thing. Make sure to schedule regular operating system updates or just install the updates when you see them come in and check and make sure you're installing stuff that won't wreck your computer. Before cleaning any laptop components, shut them down, take out the battery, and unplug any peripherals that might be on the computer. Don't spray cleaning solution directly onto your display or onto anything. Use a cloth and wipe it. Put a little bit of cleaning solution on the cloth and then wipe it down. To ensure data integrity, it is critical that data files and folders are properly managed. Restore and recover procedures as well as backups are more successful if the data is organized, because then you won't lose anything, as I said. When moving files from a laptop to a desktop computer, start by creating similar folder structures in both locations. Files can be transferred over a network with an optical disk or with a portable drive. You should be careful that data copied from one computer does not inadvertently overwrite data on the other computer. When you are copying a file to a destination folder, you might encounter a confirm file replacement dialog. You guys have all seen this. This message indicates that Windows XP has stopped the copy process until you choose whether to replace or not to replace the original file with the file that is being transferred. If you are unsure, select No to determine which file to keep. Compare the dates and file sizes and keep the one you actually want. You may also, of course, open the file to view the contents. They really had to tell you that? Okay. No operating system allows files with the same name to exist in the same folder. Be careful not to unintentionally cut a file from its original location when you only meant to copy it. This is really important. Also, when you're working on external drives, there is no recycle bin. If you delete something, it's usually gone for good.
Dropbox can help with some of these issues, actually, of course. If you're doing things you know are going to be, this is a decent use for Dropbox if you have the bandwidth.
Absolutely. Okay.
Is there any reason to cut a file exactly?
Yeah. If you don't want to keep it in two places, you want to save on space.
When I put a book onto my NLS player,
it'll go into the clipboard.
It comes in a zip file. So what I do is I extract the zip file and it creates a folder. Well, I don't want to keep the folder. I'm going to hang on to the zip file, so I cut the folder and put it on the drive for the player, and then I don't need to worry about deleting it.
Okay. We've got the troubleshooting process, which I think we're good on. If anyone has any questions on the troubleshooting process, email me or go ahead and ask now.
I think I've got it.
Fair enough. Cool. Okay. Any other questions on anything else in the module?
I can't think of anything. Well, I feel like I had a point and it went away, but I'll probably remember it 10 minutes from now. I'm like, Dawr!
You guys, Carrie's fallen asleep. Oh, I thought you had. No?
Oh, that would have been so fun.
Might have.
That would have been great. I would so spam.
No. Okay, well, that's the end of the lecture. And no, it didn't take the whole 2 hours.